Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From the Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. That's right, Film Spotting spent the week at Sundance. And on tonight's show, Adam and I tell you the five films at this year's festival that you need to put on your 2007 calendar. And later in the show, the top five Sundance debuts of all time.
Plus, Massacre Theater, music from Utah Carol, and interviews with writer-directors Garth Jennings and Craig Brewer. But first, Sam, wanted to talk a little bit about the festival in general. We saw 20 films over basically six days.
Yeah.
And it's funny because we keep reading all these articles online from some of these jaded critics who have been at Sundance for 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
And they seem to be so disappointed with this year's festival. And they're talking about how it's just a bunch of cliched films. Maybe we're just too new to it, being our first year and all.
Possibly.
But we had a blast.
We had a blast. I can't imagine having a better time, honestly. And we'll get to this. But the three films I was looking forward to most at the festival absolutely met my expectations, so maybe that made it a lot better festival for me. But the far more of the films that we saw, I really, really liked. I mean, I put them up against any of the movies I saw in 2006,
mm-hmm.
and I'll put them against anything I see in 2007. You know, if my top five films at the Sundance Film Festival end up being my top five films of the year, I'd be perfectly satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
I've been having a really great time.
Yeah, and with that all said, there were many films that we got to that we're excited about, that we know there's a lot of buzz behind these films. We think we saw most of those films, but there are a few that we didn't get to that we really wanted to see, and those movies include a film called Waitress that stars Kerry Russell of Felicity fame. But the real key behind this one is not only did it get picked up and for a pretty significant amount of money, but Adrian Shelley was the director of it, probably
the
best
Adrian
known
Shelley,
from the movie Trust, the Hal Hartley film. She directed this film.
Yeah.
This was her labor of love, and of course she tragically was murdered about 3 or 4 months ago. This is her film. Also, Chapter 27, the movie about Mark David Chapman and the killing of John Lennon with Jared Leto apparently putting on like 50 or 60 pounds.
I think he got the gout, actually.
Yeah, he may have.
Good for him.
Yeah, and also a film called Interview with Sienna Miller and Steve Buscemi. He plays a journalist in it, and she's kind of a hotshot actress that he's forced to interview, and things get kind of crazy during the interview. He also directed that film. So those are three of the films that we missed that we really wanted to see. It is ridiculous to try to get to every film.
Really, nearly 200 films, in 6 days. We could hypothetically fill about six slots watching movies all day. One day we tried to do five.
We did.
And it nearly killed us.
Yeah.
It really honestly did.
But we did do it.
But we did do it. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, we are obviously enthusiastic about our first foray into the Sundance Film Festival. Let's go ahead and hear from someone else as enthusiastic as we are.
People say that festivals changed through the year, over the last 10 years, and it's become far more corporate and all that. I don't see it. I see going into a venue and receptive audiences who really want to embrace the films and the filmmakers. And that, to me, is why this festival is so unique and so exhilarating to bring a film here.
That's Brett Morgan, the director of the film Chicago 10, which opened the Sundance Film Festival. It was the opening night film. And, of course, he's excited about it. He has to be. But you heard some of the things he said there, again, echoing kind of the things that we're saying about the festival. And this film, we played that quote because his film, Chicago 10, is one that is a tie for our number five film that we say, if you're listening to this show, you need to mark down on your calendar. And as of right now, we aren't aware of a release date yet for it. You can go to Participant Productions. It's the company that produced it, Participant Films. They don't have a release date set for it yet, but it will come out sometime this year. And it's a documentary about the 1968 Chicago riots at the Democratic National Convention, the trial of the Chicago 7. And I told you, Sam, I think about all the moments from the festival that really stand out in my mind, that really excite me the most. And there are several of them, but one that immediately comes to mind always is the first courtroom scene from Chicago 10. And this is a movie that has animation, live action animation, that recreates this trial of the Chicago 7. And that first scene where we cut to Nick Nolte, his voice we hear doing the voice of the prosecutor who is trying this case of the Chicago 7, with the rock music blaring that plays throughout this film, I was immediately drawn into just the excitement of the animation and the music and Nick Nolte's voice introducing us to the characters of the Chicago 7. That energy I was drawn into right away. And it's a film that we've talked earlier this week, actually. We did some dispatches from Sundance. We talked about the film. It's obviously a flawed film, or at least we would say with many critics who are mixed on it, that there are flaws, but I liked it a lot. It's my number five.
And maybe its successes are limited just by the fact of its ambition being so focused. It really is trying to remove this historical incident from its historical context in some way as a way to communicate the message of here's what it was like to have a vibrant anti-war movement. Mm-hmm. Isn't that relevant to our time? And speaking directly to college-age, high school-age kids, and I think we agree that it succeeds in that. Does it succeed ultimately in terms of being relevant to all audiences? I'm not sure.
Maybe not.
But that's not really what he's trying to do.
No, exactly.
So it's an admirable thing. My number five film here at the Sundance Film Festival, another film we're not sure about the release date, but everyone was sure that it's going to get distributed at some point this year. It is David Gordon Green's Snow Angels. It was one of the films I was really looking forward to at the festival here. David Gordon Green, not widely known, I think it's safe to say, by most audiences, general audiences, but is a kind of indie celebrity. A young guy. I think he's probably our age, Adam, probably 30, 31. This is his fourth feature film. I think all of his previous films, George Washington, All the Real Girls, Undertow, played the Sundance Film Festival and were celebrated there. This film, I think, you know, what made David Gordon Green's film's really special in the past, particularly for me, his first, George Washington, is this kind of dreamy, improvisational quality that he brings to his films that really is unique. And with this film, well, I should say with his previous film, Undertow, he really attempted a kind of genre filmmaking that I feel like he didn't quite have a handle on. It still had some of these really wonderful David Gordon Green moments that made it worth seeing, but here I really feel like I see a real maturity in his filmmaking. I mean, this story, it's an adaptation of a Stuart Onan novel about this tragedy that takes place in a small town, but also about these three relationships, one just beginning, two that are at some degree of ending or disintegrating, and it really requires a narrative strength. I mean, there's a lot of balls in the air. There's a lot of characters. These themes of loss and redemption are being it's his responsibility to carry, and he really, really does. And at the same time, there are these wonderful, wonderful moments of just reality. Like, you're just living with these characters, this sense of spontaneity that he creates in his cast. Sam Rockwell, Kate Beckinsale are the leads. They're both wonderful. Rockwell is one of our favorite actors, too. Fun actors to watch on screen, and he's wonderful in this. The fact that it met and maybe exceeded my expectations, that was one of the pleasures of the festival.
Yeah, I was with you on this film, too. Liked it very much. And these next four picks we agree with. These are the four films we're saying you definitely have to check out. And number four is a film called The Pool, directed by Chris Smith, who is a Milwaukee-based filmmaker. Broke out at Sundance with his movie American Movie, and it's a movie I'll set up real quick. It was actually shot in India and is in Hindi, and it's really the story of an 18-year-old kid who is a working-class kid, and he is just kind of struggling to get by, and he becomes infatuated with this pool that is behind the gate of this home that is obviously from a wealthy family that doesn't seem to be there, and then they show up. There are inhabitants, and every day he just goes and looks at this pool and wants to get close to it, wants to take a dip in that pool, and that really propels the whole narrative forward. It is a movie that I think is really free of melodrama, and yet by the end becomes quite moving. And a lot like Snow Angels, I think you can use that word naturalism about it. You have actors here who are non-actors in many cases, and watching them, you get the sense that they are just doing exactly what they would do on a daily basis.
Yeah, and I feel like with The Pool, too, you have this documentary filmmaker. The first part of the film feels certainly interesting, but not compelling narratively, necessarily. Yeah. But as the film goes forward, there is a moment where the narrative really turns a corner, and it becomes incredibly compelling, a really good film. The third film we think you need to keep an eye on, again, a film that has been picked up for distribution, was picked up earlier in the week, so it will come out at some point this year. It is Grace Is Gone, written and directed by James Strauss, stars John Cusack as a Minnesota man whose wife has been deployed in Iraq. He has two young daughters. At some point early in the film, he does learn that his wife has died. And really, the rest of the film is him really avoiding, finding a way to avoid telling his daughters what's happened. It's one of these moments where he misses the opportunity to tell them, and then can't find the moment again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only is it obviously really relevant to what's going on in the news right now, it's also this wonderfully human story. Of course, you'd think it'd be just punishing to sit through, really, as you know. The hammer is going to fall on these kids at some point in the film, but there's really wonderful moments of lightness,
mm-hmm.
Humor between John Cusack and his daughters, between the daughters, just capturing that sense,
yep.
As well as really, you know, carrying the weight of this this political message as
uh-huh.
well. I mean, in terms of the responsibility of, say, a father to his children and, let's say, you know, a leader in government to
yeah.
his constituents.
It's yeah, really James Strauss with his directorial debut here, his feature debut. I mean, he really allows time for both sides of the debate on the
yep.
Iraq war in terms of a red state, blue state perspective, and he doesn't judge anyone for their views. And we really loved the actor Alessandro Nivola here as a supporting role to John Cusack. He plays his brother, and he's only in the film for about 10 minutes,
yeah.
but really stands out.
Yeah.
Shalane O'Keefe as his older daughter
is
also
wonderful.
Really good, and John Cusack, I think, gives a good performance as well. And it was purchased for $4 million by the Weinsteins, and it's expected to be released around October or November for, you know, the big award season.
Yeah.
So look forward to that one. Grace is Gone. Our number two pick is a film called Black Snake Moan, written and directed by Craig Brewer, who had a breakout in 2005 with the movie Hustle and Flow. And this is a film with Samuel L. Jackson as a man named Lazarus, an old blues singer who tries to heal a troubled nymphomaniac, basically, we can call
yeah.
her, played by Christina Ricci, down in Tennessee. He tries to heal her by chaining her to his radiator and giving her some good meals and playing some blues and just talking to her and giving her some love and affection, basically. And we were really blown away by this film, despite having really high expectations for it because of Brewer and Hustle and Flow and the cast. And
yeah.
we both walked out thinking, when was the last time you saw Samuel L. Jackson give that good of a performance?
Yeah, where you were reminded of how good an actor he is. I mean, I think we can say safely that we like Samuel L. Jackson as like a presence in films.
Mm-hmm.
He's always interesting to watch. Somebody that can make, you know, speaking of snakes, you know, Snakes on a Plane
yeah.
work just through sheer force of persona. But this is a solid, solid performance and just speaks to, I mean, the word that immediately comes to mind when you're watching this is fearlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the performances, Christina Ricci, of course, and maybe first and foremost, but that's got to come from Brewer. I mean, this film wouldn't work with anyone else directing it
probably
or involved.
Not.
I mean, it really, and his knowledge and his love of music just comes through again, like it did in Hustle and Flow. It does here too. It's here. It's blues. I mean, I feel lame saying this, but I felt like I learned something
you
about
do.
The blues that I didn't understand
yeah.
before.
No, I think Brewer actually directs the film like a blues musician,
yeah.
and you have these kind of big, huge visual and musical flourishes, but with plenty of quiet moments throughout. But even those really quiet moments, like a kind of slow, really slow, gritty blues tune, have an intensity to them. And Samuel L. Jackson, not only his performance great, but his performance as this blues musician, it's actually him
it's
playing
stunning.
The guitar
it is completely
and him
stunning.
Singing. And it is stunning in the same way Terrence Howard was
yes.
stunning in Hustle and Flow, because those rap songs had to work. You
they
had
have
to see
authentic.
The magic in
There's
them. They had to be authentic.
Here,
and they
yeah.
are, and they're exciting. And here the blues songs are really incredible, and the performances are incredible. So we had a great theater experience
yeah.
with that, too. We saw the world
oh, yeah.
premiere
yes.
in a theater with 1,200 people who were into the film every moment, and the producer, John Singleton, was there, and Craig Brewer, and Justin Timberlake is in the film, and Christina Ricci and Samuel
yeah.
L. Jackson, and they answered questions afterwards, and it was a great time. So that is our number two, Black Snake Moan, which actually is going to be opening soon. You
Very
can see
soon.
This one February 23rd. Which leads us to our number one film, though, Sam. As much as we like Black Snake Moan, the
Boy.
Film that we really want to push people to go see when it is finally released, and again, no release date set for it yet, but it was picked up for $7 million, actually
yeah.
the biggest buy of the festival
right.
by Paramount Vantage, and that's the film Son of Rambo.
Son of Rambo from director Garth Jennings. His directorial debut, 2005, was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, this adaptation of this much-loved book, huge expectations for this film, a lot of pressure. Here, he and his producing partner went under the radar. Nobody really knew he was making this film. Very personal film about these two young boys that come from very different backgrounds getting together and developing a friendship over really a home movie version remake of First Blood, Rambo. It's just the fact that it really captures this sense of childhood imagination
mm-hmm.
in a way that I don't think either of us had ever seen before. You also see on display, and it's something I saw in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, you know, this is somebody, this is a filmmaker with just seems like a bottomless well of imagination and playfulness,
mm-hmm.
Where he was really able to tap in to that sense of what it was like to be a child, what it was like in the mid-80s to have a video camera and see that as, you know, limitless possibility, you know,
mm-hmm.
And to see that on screen. I mean, the kids in this film
are
unbelievable. And we'll hear from Garth Jennings later in the show talking about how he found these kids and what it was like to work with them. But yeah, like you said, this is the film that we want everyone we know to see.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to imagine anyone not liking it.
True.
So this is really, really exciting.
It's a crowd pleaser.
To know that, yeah, this is something we got to see at the beginning of the year that will hopefully be giving people pleasure throughout 2007.
Yeah, I said it, and I'll say it again. It was the funniest film I saw at the festival,
yeah.
I think you'll agree, and maybe the most inspirational. Actually, I'll say it was the most inspirational because I expect it to inspire a whole generation of filmmakers.
It's
I know
true.
I had seen it when I was a kid.
Oh my gosh.
I think it would have inspired me in that way.
Yeah.
So a great film, Son of Rambo. We recorded 3 dispatches from Sundance, Sam, during the week where we reviewed about 14 movies that we saw kind of right after we saw them, put the show up the next day. So if you want to go to filmspotting.net and hear more about some of these films, you can do that. Go to filmspotting.net to listen to those shows.
That's right. After the break, some thoughts on this week's Oscar nominations and an interview with the director and producer of Son of Rambo, Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith, who tell us how the first X-rated film to win Best Picture influenced their film about grade schoolers. Stay with us. Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. We're here in Park City at the Sundance Film Festival, but before we get to more on that, Oscar nominations were announced on Tuesday.
Yes,
Adam.
They were.
I guess let's get to, I think we can admit there weren't a lot of surprises.
No.
In fact, there were almost no surprises. Among those things that weren't surprises, there were a few maybe personal disappointments. Why don't you get to yours?
Yeah, I had a couple of personal disappointments. That's a good way to put it. My first one would be seeing Babel get a Best Picture nomination. I know
film
it's a film
I really, really admired
and
loved. Yeah.
Really loved, but it's a film, as I've said many times on previous shows, that I respect the technique of quite a bit, but as one critic I read put it, I think very well, it's like taking a flu shot, and I really take no pleasure in watching characters suffer on screen for 2 hours for my enlightenment. So I don't like Babel, and it was unfortunate to see it get the nomination for Best Picture, and even sadder is I think it probably will win. I would have preferred to have seen United 93 get the nomination, but I was at least happy that Paul Greengrass was thrown a bone for directing and got a nom there. Also, I was disappointed to see nothing for Maggie Gyllenhaal. My fellow Chicago film critics in the Chicago Film Critics Association at least nominated her for Best Actress for her work in Sherry Baby. I think she was fantastic there. My favorite female performance of the year. I think she should have got a nomination, obviously. And I also think she was fantastic in supporting turns in Stranger Than Fiction and World Trade Center. So disappointed that Maggie Gyllenhaal didn't get any love from the Academy this year.
You just think she's pretty.
I do, but she's talented as well.
She is
Sam.
Talented as well. I agree. Well, I'll counter your Babel hate with my own with Little Miss Sunshine, a film which had its debut at the Sundance Film Festival last year in 2006. If we can take one of those films that debuted at Sundance in 2006, let's drop Little Miss Sunshine if we could, and take Half Nelson, mm-hmm. a film which, thankfully, Ryan Gosling's incredible performance in it was given a nomination. But Little Miss Sunshine, not a fan, as I've said frequently on the show. But I don't mind. I love to see Abigail Breslin get nominated for supporting actress, which I think really says a lot about the direction, the sensitivity of the direction for that performance. She's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I don't even think Alan Arkin is great in it, but I love Alan Arkin.
Right,
so
we like to see
his get nomination. That's fine. I really think it's the screenplay nomination and the Best Picture nomination that, again, a personal disappointment.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to take issue with the Academy here, but life goes on.
Yeah. Well, the good part for you is that Little Miss Sunshine is not going to win.
That's so at true. Least right.
You can
it's
look at the bright
Departed
side there.
Or, like you said, Babel.
Babel.
Yep. Which I'll be perfectly pleased with.
You don't seem to want to accept the fact that you're dealing with an expert in guerrilla warfare. With a man who's the best. With guns, with knives, with his bare hands. A man who's been trained to ignore pain. Ignore weather. To live off the land. To eat things and to make a billy goat puke. In Vietnam, his job was to dispose of enemy personnel. To kill. Period. Win by attrition. Well, Rambo was the best.
That clip, of course, Sylvester Stallone in First Blood from 1985, a film that had a tremendous influence on me, I know, back then as well, and it has special significance for a couple of the characters, as we discussed in Garth Jennings' new film, Son of Rambo. It was our favorite film that we saw at the Sundance Film Festival, and Sam, you had a great opportunity to actually meet with the people responsible for Son of Rambo.
That's right. I sat down with Garth Jennings and his producing partner, Nick Goldsmith, at, as you'll hear, the bustling Airborne Lounge on Main Street in Park City earlier this week to talk about their new film. If I tell people that the film that most influenced Son of Rambo, a film about grade schoolers, is Midnight Cowboy, they may get the wrong idea.
Yes, they would.
Can you
yes.
explain a little bit?
Yes, it's not at all like Midnight Cowboy, but it was one of those. That was actually one of the movies we loved because it was sort of at its heart. It's a love story. It's about two very different characters, you know, sort of finding that they actually get on rather well. And I think we've often found that those are the kind of films we like the most, where you know they're just at their heart, at their core, a very simple, heartfelt story. You know, and then really Son of Rambo, although it's about two kids making a sequel to First Blood and their own home movie and all this sort of stuff, really it's a tale about friendship. Yeah,
and not about male prostitution at all.
Not at all about male prostitution.
Oh, yeah. No. Although someone did say, "What is the letter that the kid called Duncan gives Didier at the end?"
Oh yes,
something to do with. It's not.
Okay,
it's definitely not.
We'll clear that up.
It's
right.
definitely
yes.
not.
Well, if Midnight Cowboy influenced your film, the film that inspires the kids in the film, Will Proudfoot and Lee Carter is, as you mentioned, First Blood. How much of Son of Rambo is based on your own childhoods?
It started. The idea for this film started as just a bunch of notes I made on my own childhood. I'd sort of grown up with making little home movies with my dad's video camera, and when we saw there was a whole little gang of us, and we saw a pirate copy of First Blood when we were about 11 years old, and it completely blew us away, and we ended up making our own little versions of Rambo. And that, along with a lot of the other characters and events of I experienced as a kid, I'd written down as a story, but as a bunch of notes. But from there, we used that as a starting point to kind of develop a film that would just try and capture how lovely it is to be that age and when anything's possible and you do not consider the consequences. So that's kind of what we did, yeah.
I saw the film at a press screening yesterday, and I loved it. I just want this on the record. It's my favorite experience at the festival. I absolutely loved it. But it was a press screening, which tends to be a little more subdued, and I saw that the first screening, anyway, at Sundance this week was Monday night at the Eccles Theater, capacity like 1,200 people. I was wondering if you were there and what the experience was like.
Yeah, well, we were there. We turned up with him. We were asked to introduce the film prior to it starting, so it was quite weird standing in the wings and looking at poking your head around the corner and going, wow, there's a lot of people in there. Hey, and one of them's Bono.
Yeah.
That was weird.
Yeah. Wow, seriously?
Yeah. So it was
he liked it.
But it was quite strange because we finished the film a week prior to showing it. So the most we've shown it to, maybe the biggest audience we've shown it to, is maybe 20 people of family and friends. So that was quite weird. So you know, there was a bit of shaking going on.
It really does feel in some way like a theatrical experience in a way most movie screenings aren't. I feel like I've been to a couple, you know, festival screening. It's like some of these films will never ever get an audience like they do maybe on that first night of Sundance.
Or... Yeah,
I was planning on not staying.
That's true.
Because yeah. I was quite nervous and I wasn't sure whether I wanted to put myself through watching it, and I'm so pleased I did, because it was a wonderful experience.
So people were really responding to it.
Yeah.
I mean,
the audience, they even sort of like, they responded to parts of the film which we didn't even think that they might get or respond to. So it was just very reassuring.
Was there a Q&A afterwards? Did people have any questions?
Yes,
for you?
Yeah. I did the Q&A on my own in the end. And it was actually really good fun, because I was so thrilled with how it played. It was very easy to get up then afterwards, much easier than it was to introduce it.
The kids in the film, Bill Milner and Will Poulter, are just outstanding, and apparently they have never acted on screen before. And there's this precision as well as a playfulness to the performances and the film, which I love. And I wondered how you were able to create that sense of playfulness on the set, because they look like they're having a blast on screen.
You're absolutely right. That what you see on the screen is pretty much what they're like in real life. They are two of the most charming and natural individuals. There is nothing manufactured about their performance. They're very playful people, and they've got a very charming. They've both got very charming characters, and it took a long while to find them, because we didn't want to go through the usual sort of stage schools to find those. You know, because often you get very professional children, but there's, I don't know, it just wasn't right for this. We wanted something quite natural. It's harder to find, so we spent 5 months auditioning children and going to all the different schools, and in the end they were almost the last two that came through the door. And it's very much like a sort of, the minute we saw them, Nick and I both knew that they were the right people for the part. And from there it's so easy. They were so, like, once you had them, they were so right that it was a very easy movie to direct.
It's still incredible, because you see so many films that have child actors, and there's just a stiffness, an awkwardness, a professionalism about it, and I still think there's got to be a reason people do that. If they know they can hit their marks, they know they'll show up on time, learn their lines. But
it's very interesting that, though, because what we found with these two is that they'd never been in front of a camera before. One of them had been in the school production of The Wizard of Oz as a munchkin. That was it. That was the level.
Didn't even
of
the lead. No.
Yeah, you know. But the thing is, they saw everything as a kind of game. Like, learning their lines was a kind of test.
Wow.
And you'd say, right, you've got to walk from here, hit that mark, go over there, pick that up, then throw the ball at him, and then say your line aggressively. And they would see that as a kind of, right, okay, I can do that. And they'd get really frustrated if they got it wrong. Like, no, let me do it again.
And, there was a tiny bit about doing each other as well.
Yeah.
Did it really well. The other one would make sure that he did it even better.
And that was a natural outgrowth of the direction. It wasn't like that was a strategy on your part. Worked out.
Yeah.
I think our only strategy, I think, that we talked about as far as how to handle the kids was just to make sure that, like, we were having fun on the shoot, and that it wasn't, that they were having fun as well. We want it to become like a family. I mean, it sounds a bit sort of wet, but it's like...
No, it's true. It really is. You have to get it so that the environment is very comfortable for them, isn't it? That they feel happy to cry in front of the camera crew.
Sure.
You know, when you're 13 years old, that could be the opposite of how you'd feel very uncomfortable doing that. So creating the right sort of atmosphere really meant that we could get those things, you know.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. I'm here with Garth Jennings and Nick Goldsmith, whose new film, Son of Rambo, is here at Sundance. I wanted to talk about, you made your directorial film debut with A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in 2005.
Yeah.
And this was a film that really had been in development, or some stage of development, for 20 years.
That's right,
tons
yeah.
of screenwriters, a lot of directors attached. Huge expectation in terms of the worldwide audience that absolutely adores this book. And here you are. It's your first film. Of course, you've been working in commercials and music videos with Hammer and Tongs. But I guess not only what was that like, but what was it like to then go to something like this? Much more personal, under the radar,
Well, it was exactly that. That one, The Hitchhikers, was all expectation.
No pressure.
Yeah. I mean, it was like before we'd even start shooting, people had decided whether it was going to be any good or not. It was a wonderful experience doing Hitchhikers, a huge experience. And I think having had that experience, it made this one, making Son of Rambo, even more delightful because it was so under the radar. There was no one knew what we were doing. It wasn't like we were trying to be secretive. There just wasn't any interest in it. It was wonderful. So we just got on. Nick and I just did it ourselves. We had no other producers there, there was no studio involved. And that's not that that's a, you know, that I'm against that. It was just like this film was made in just the right way, I feel like. We were allowed to just go and get on with it.
I just have a final question. What's next for you?
Sleep? No.
Yes.
You just finished it, like you said.
Just finished it, and it's like, what's next for us is, you know, it's going to get released in the summer, hopefully. So we'd love to be involved as much as possible as how that happens, because, you know, we've made this thing. It's like we don't just want to just hand it over and have nothing more to do with it. There's a lot of involvement still for us in this film. I think, you know, we don't have another project immediately to go. We'll go back, do some more music videos, do some commercials, and think up our next film idea.
Yeah. You know that thing as well, when you've done something for so long, the same thing for so long, you need to go and read some books and watch some films and get excited about stuff again. And that's why we're both taking a week off next week to just sort of
a whole
not
week.
Do anything to do with this. Not that we're against it, but I think you've got to get excited about stuff again.
Yeah, the input-output ratio.
Yes. Yeah.
We're only good at doing one thing at a time.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Nick, Garth. Thanks so much for your time, and good luck with the film.
Thank you very much.
That was director Garth Jennings and producer Nick Goldsmith, the filmmakers behind Son of Rambo. When Film Spotting returns, your chance at a free DVD in Massacre Theater, and Black Snake Moan director Craig Brewer tells me how he came up with the idea to have Samuel L. Jackson chain Christina Ricci to a radiator. Stay with us.
When it's cold, it's twilight time. I feel like I don't have long to go. I look beyond the winter sky. I see her smile in the falling snow. When the sun sets in your eyes, I know I won't be afraid. Night when I'm safe and sound, all I want is you. When the sun sets in your eyes, I know I won't be afraid. At night when I'm safe and sound, all I want is you.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's a big week for new DVD releases. We'll start out with the small stuff, Sam. Hannibal Lecter Collection is out now.
Beautiful.
Catch a Fire,
Masterful.
A movie from last year that you saw, I have yet to see.
That's
and
right.
Passion of the Christ, the two-disc definitive edition.
Wow.
But
deleted
really,
scenes,
it doesn't
extras.
Matter. Yeah, yeah, and extra beatings. But
extra
really whiplashes. What we have now is the definitive edition of...
Yes.
The camp classic.
Oh, finally. Matt Singer.
Matt Singer,
are you out there?
Yeah. Gymkhana, the 1985 film. Film Spotting listeners helped make it happen with their votes on Amazon.com. It is out now this week. Gymkhana.
I love it.
Check it out.
I think we should devote an entire show to reviewing Gymkhana.
We may have to.
Have Matt Singer on the show. We've got to make this happen.
Yeah, we do. In fact, you know what? Gymkhana should be the first film that we do a DVD commentary on.
Commentary on.
Me, you, Matt Singer. It's Parmistan. It's golden tea, Sam.
It's golden tea. Looking for a fun place to get movies for less? Check out the all-new PureFlix.com, featuring better trading, a forum to connect with other movie fans, and the ability to use trade cash to receive DVDs from other members instead of peer bucks. Once you have $100, you can also have the option to cash out. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we absolutely ruin a film we love, and you get a shot at a free DVD.
On the last Film Spotting podcast, Adam and I massacred Mulholland Drive. That was a tie-in with our top five breakthroughs of 2006. Naomi Watts, of course, made her breakthrough performance in Mulholland Drive, and conveniently a tie-in with Lynch's new film, Inland Empire, which actually just opened this weekend at the Music Box right here in Chicago. Adam, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Mike Thomas from Oak Park, Illinois.
Oh,
congratulations,
Oak Park,
Mike.
Represent.
Yeah, just down the road here. Congratulations, Mike. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
I think your dialogue is beautiful. I really do. I love it.
Then why the hell don't you just stand still and say it instead of wandering all over the stage? You're supposed to be looking for your soul, not an ashtray.
It is time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and the only hint we're going to give here is that it ties in with Sundance sort of tangentially.
Yes, and if you were listening to the first segment of the show...
To the first segment of the show, this choice might make sense to you because it does tie in with one of the actors or directors, we'll say, from
sure,
the first segment.
Sure.
Okay.
We
I probably said too much. Sam, is that what you're giving me that look for?
Okay.
Well, you started off, so
my
I will give...
My acting is going to give it away.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give you the action. And action.
Fine woman, Floris. I don't know how she puts up with this damn speech impediment of mine.
You don't have a speech impediment, Dr. Blank.
Flattery will get you everywhere, my boy. But I'm afraid I have to trust Floris on this one. You see, she has her doctorate in speech impedimentology from Case Western. I apologize if you can't understand a word I'm saying, Dr. Blank.
No, I understand perfectly.
Thank you for being kind enough to lie. You see, I've been very lonely in my isolated tower of indecipherable speech. You're hired. Any questions?
And scene. And the Oscar
I
should
apologize
go to
the
Van Halgren.
Audience, actually, for my indecipherable speech. Really?
Yeah, really? I think you did a fine job there, Sam. And if you know what film we just massacred, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the next episode of the weekly Film Spotting podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, just visit filmspotting.net.
Why you got me chained?
You let them men treat you like that.
What the hell you know about me?
God put you in my path, and I aim to cure you of your wickedness. Get your ass back in my house!
What you thinking?
A half-naked white woman chained up in your house?
I done made up my mind on this. I ain't gonna be moved.
That's a clip, Sam, from the trailer for Black Snake Moan. It was
should give you an indication of how polarizing this
may be. Yeah. But it was our second favorite film from the Sundance Film Festival this year, and I was extremely happy to get a chance to sit down with the writer and director of the film, Craig Brewer, at the festival. Here's the interview. I had a chance to talk to a colleague this morning just for a brief amount of time, and he said he had seen the movie. I told him we were going to see it, and his response was, it's pretty insane.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a reasonable response, and what do you think he meant?
Well, you know, I think I make intense movies, but I think at the same time, I really sincerely believe in the humanity of the characters. So no matter what crazy situations we find ourselves in, whether it's a pimp outlandishly thinking that he can... you know, ascend to rap stardom by making an album in his house. You know, we have the same thing here with a kind of a wayward girl who's lost her mind a little bit, and an old black bluesman who thinks he can help her by chaining her up to his radiator in his house out in the country, and trying to sing some songs to her and cook her some good meals and get some God into her. You know,
how did this project come about? How did the script come about and start?
Well, I'll be honest. What it was is I'd written Hustle and Flow, and I was trying to get it made. I thought I was going to be making it just with a handheld video camera, but I got a couple of people interested in Hollywood. And so there's about two really stressful years of being flown back and forth and people telling me that, you know, we really want to make this movie, but not with you or not with Terrence Howard. Mm. And it was very stressful. And my father had died of a heart attack at age 49. And I was on a plane and I started to feel this throbbing in my chest, and I began to sweat, and my breathing just suddenly got out of control. And I called over a stewardess and I said, I believe I'm having a heart attack. My father died of a heart attack at 49, and, wow. And I don't know what to do. And she calmly sat down next to me and started asking me some questions. And she said, I think you're having like a panic or an anxiety attack. And I said, I've flown all my life. I'm not afraid to fly. Something's happening here. And she was right. So it began to really, I just started losing control a little bit. And I found out that my wife was experiencing the same thing, and we hadn't really told each other about it.
Huh.
And I named it. I called it The Black Snake Moan, which is a blues song by Blind Lemon Jefferson about something being in his room that he didn't know where it was or what it was, but it was going to consume him and take his soul. And so that's really where the whole idea of this type of movie came about, was from me kind of losing my mind a little bit.
Well, you mentioned Terrence Howard, and to go back to Hustle and Flow for a second, it was one of our favorite films of the year here on Film Spotting. His performance in particular stood out, and you kind of mentioned maybe that the studios weren't necessarily into him. Was he someone that you always had in mind for that role?
I you know, when I wrote the role, I really didn't have anybody in mind, but once I knew that Terrence Howard was my guy, I wouldn't give up.
Yeah.
There was even this really memorable phone conversation that I think really solidified our friendship and our respect for each other, because a studio basically said, you know, we'll do it just without Terrence.
Huh.
And I called, and Terrence found out about that, and he called me and he said, Craig, look, it's been about a year, we've been trying to do it, move on, get a rapper, you know, you did your best. And I said, are you listening to me, Terrence Howard? I said, I am not doing this movie without you, so if you don't mind doing like a $500,000 digital video movie, we're going to make Hustle and Flow. And I think from that moment on, things are very different between Terrence and I. We really were watching each other's back. And now, after our careers have really kind of, you know, taken off, we still are that close with each other. We still are very caring towards each other, because, you know, no one wanted us. And now we're it.
We're here on Film Spotting with director Craig Brewer. His latest film is Black Snake Moan. His last film was Hustle and Flow, we're talking about a little bit. And I'm curious, how was the success of Hustle and Flow? How did that make this project easier or potentially harder?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I wrote Black Snake Moan right after Hustle and Flow. And so I wrote it before the movie Hustle and Flow was made. So when Hustle won at Sundance, I had... You know, I had my script in hand. Like, I was like, well, if y'all like this one, maybe you could give me some money this time, and I'll make this Black Snake Moan. So there's all these executives who just lost out on the bidding war of Hustle, who now are flying back to L.A. with Black Snake Moan in their hands. And they're like, oh, man, we thought this guy was not going to go back in the direction of Hustle. We wanted something a little bit more homogenized, something a little nicer. And here's this movie. Uh-huh. Here's this script about a young white girl, nymphomaniac, chained up to this old black man's radiator. How are we going to do this?
Right.
Well, that's when Sam got involved, and Christina and Paramount Vantage really got behind it. And to be honest with you, I immediately was filming, like no interference from the studio. Mm. They really just said, "Hey, if you're making your decision to do this movie and not some, you know, high budget sequel or something like that, then we're going to support you."
Mm-hmm. Both of these films, and you touch on this a little bit, are very much about redemption and characters being redeemed in some way, redeeming each other. Mm-hmm. Is that a theme that has always interested you?
It particularly interests me when we talk about Southern storytelling and Southern culture, because I really, Black Snake Moan, even in its structure, is kind of almost like a two-act movie. And I always imagined that, if you were to experience Black Snake Moan as a record, you would have one side and then flip it over and have another, and one side would be sin and the other side would be salvation. You're dealing with a culture that that parties on Saturday night and gets drunk and falls into bed with people they probably shouldn't be falling into bed with, and And then they wake up Sunday morning and they go into church and they're still singing and still sweating and trying to get a little bit of salvation before Monday, yeah. And it all starts again. And living in the South, I experienced that ebb and flow, that cycle that of seasons almost during a work week even, mm-hmm. that I knew that's what I wanted this movie to feel like. So redemption is very much a part, almost a weekly occurrence in the South.
Well, you mentioned singing at church for salvation, and both of these films obviously are very much about music as well. Is that something you see as redemptive?
I do, and particularly in the blues, because if you think about the lyrics in blues music, they're all talking about fear. You know, went down to the crossroads, mm-hmm. fell down to my knees. You know, Lord, you know, Bob's after me. God, help me if you please. Uh-huh. You know, and there's all of these evil elements in the music that they sing sometimes three times in a row, whether it be, you know, my woman left me, mm-hmm. or the levee broke. But those musicians, I think, by articulating the fears and articulating the anger, and singing it out loud, I think it took away some of its power over them, and they began to have more power over it. And that's really the journey that that Sam Jackson's character takes with in Black Snake Moan with Christina Ricci's character. To some extent, you almost have to grab hold of misery and sing loud with it and write it out. And only then really when you exhaust yourself completely, can you truly find peace?
Hmm. Well, you had Black Snake Moan ready, as you said, when Hustle was breaking out. What's next for you?
Well, you know, I really am inspired by the music of my state, and it's about time for me to put some of this crazy darkness behind me, uh-huh. and it's time for me to do an outlaw country music movie. And
fantastic.
So my next movie is called Maggie Lynn.
Okay. Yeah. Great. And when can we expect that? Do you know?
I'm going to be shooting it probably later this year.
Okay. Yeah. Have you had to talk about Sundance just for a second? I know you have been promoting the film, but have you had a chance to check out any films and have any stood out for you?
Well, there's one movie that I'm seeing. I'm so busy really with the press that I was really upset that I couldn't see the one movie that I wanted to see, which is called Son of Rambo. But
yeah,
I'm hearing,
saw it yesterday.
Yeah, I'm going to see it tomorrow, and I'm a huge First Blood fan. And
uh-huh.
when I heard this premise, I was like, oh, man, I have to see this movie. So,
well, we're talking on the same show that this is going to air. We're talking to Garth Jennings, and the film really is incredible. I hope you enjoy it. I'm sure you will.
Sure I will.
Well, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Craig Brewer, writer, director of Black Snake Moan. Time for one last quick break. When we come back, the five best Sundance debuts ever.
I watched the old man dream of how it used to be. He plowed the open fields, he fished the clear blue stream. Drove a million miles just to watch her smile. They saw the northern skies. I'll be with you till I die. I watch the old man dream. It makes me think love is real.
Again, podcast listeners, we wanted to take a moment to thank everyone who was so generous over the last 10 days or so to go to filmspotting.net, click on one of the PayPal links, and send a few bucks our way. You did help finance.
Helping us, keeping us fed at Sundance.
Yes, exactly, yeah. At Sundance, keeping us
$3 scones,
lots,
people,
and,
so
yes,
seriously,
right,
thank you.
Starbucks, everything. You were instrumental in our fun at Sundance, and hopefully we paid you back with some proper coverage.
Content,
we'll see. So anyway, we want to thank those people who donated. Sam, take it away.
Yeah, a couple Gold Club members right off the top here. Justin, Stay on the Half Pipe. Scott, the Red Iguana. And a couple Silver Club members. Adam, President Garfield Loves Lasagna. And Paul, Speaking in Riddles. And then thank you also to Brett, Inconsistency of Choices, a.k.a. Sparta, Merriman, our good friend. Harlan, Keeping My Night Job. Scott, Bongs Before Breakfast. Robert, Reserved for Elvis. And Karen, Government Issue Cupcakes. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry for all the in-jokes. Those are all we, Adam and I, have spent every waking minute, and actually sleeping minute.
Yes.
Since last Saturday, these are all, this is a happy result of our week together. These sort of in-jokes, films, references to films, people we've seen and known. So these are very special nicknames. Use them with pleasure and caution.
Yeah, they all come out of the Sundance Film Festival, and maybe the in-jokes will become out-jokes as
possibly
the
over time.
Year goes on. You'll start to get more of these references, some great ones there. Nicely done by you, Sam, and thank you again to everyone who donated.
This is Ryan Johnson, the writer and director of Brick, and you are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Adam Kempinar. I'm Sam Van Halgren. Adam, at the top of the show, we talked about the five films that we want everyone to see, that we got a chance to see here at the 2007 Sundance Film Festival. Now it's time to give our top five Sundance debuts of all time. Really, the top five debuts we wish we had been at.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start first with maybe one of our less conventional picks, the premiere we wish we had been able to be at. And then we'll get to a shared top five that I think we can just agree on. Those were Sundance debuts that were not to be missed.
Certainly memorable Sundance debuts, you're right. And my first pick would be one that goes way back to 1985 when the Sundance Film Festival actually became the Sundance Film Festival, and that's the Coen Brothers film Blood Simple, a nice new kind of take on the noir film with Frances McDormand in that film and Emmett Walsh. And it won the Audience Award for Dramatic Film there in 1985, and just the Coen Brothers, it's their debut, would have loved to have obviously had that experience of seeing the Coen Brothers make their debut and seen the reaction to it.
I would have loved to have seen that too, and I was 11 years old at the time.
Exactly.
It would have been fantastic. Mine, Big Night, 1996, Sundance Film Festival, this film directed by Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott, written by Stanley Tucci, starring Tucci and Tony Shalhoub. Wonderful, one of my favorite small films about these two Italian brothers that come to the United States, open a restaurant that just fails as a restaurant nearby owned by Ian Holm just, blows up because he's turning Italian food into a carnival park, basically, selling it to Americans. And wonderful, wonderful acting. Tony Shalhoub is just incredible in it. And I think there's just this bravura feast sequence, Italian feast sequence, as they wait for Louis Prima to come. They might as well be waiting for Godot. He does not come, but they have this feast, and it is a celebration. And I think that would be something to see at a festival audience that's thrilled about the movie. I would have loved to have been there in 96.
A great choice. Those are our kind of overlooked Sundance debuts, but now it is time for the official top five list, the five movies we would have loved to have seen at Sundance. And our number five pick is the film American Movie, directed by Chris Smith, who we saw
Milwaukee native, his film
The Pool was our number four choice from this year. And back in 1999, he won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Documentary. And it's the story of a Milwaukee movie freak, Mark Borchard, trying to finish his horror movie, Coven. He pronounces it, Coven. And with the crowd of industry people, we're obviously there, whether it's press screenings with the press and industry, or you're just at these other big public screenings. The fact is, you have a lot of people who are obviously there because they're obsessed with film or somehow work in the film industry, and they laugh at every single inside joke, we noticed that, or every single kind of film reference. And to see a movie like American Movie, one that really is hilarious and obviously about the love of making films, that would have gone over well, and I could just imagine the crowd just reacting hysterically to it, which would have made it even more fun than it already is. It's a film that we both love.
Oh, sure, yeah. Number four, a film that really kind of changed the rules, certainly changed the landscape of independent film at the time. In 1989, Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape became the highest-grossing independent film of all time. Soderbergh went on to be nominated for a Best Screenplay Oscar, and it's a film I don't think maybe would have the same electrifying audience response.
Probably
it's a
not.
Bit of a downer. Mm-hmm. It's a film about infidelity. Of course, the themes are in the title of
yeah.
the film. But certainly Soderbergh, you know, certainly for me, one of the most exciting filmmakers working today, it's his first film. Seeing that, seeing a new filmmaker with his first film, I think that would be something. But yeah, seeing just I think being a part of there as the independent film world is really changing
mm-hmm.
With this event, you know, with this debut,
right.
and certainly after Sundance, things changed, and that would have been thrilling.
Yeah, it would have been fun. I think that is the big key behind this film, a movie I really do like, as you do. But being able to go back, and obviously it was a seminal film. So what was the reaction like
yeah.
that first screening? How did
yeah.
people?
What was the buzz?
Did
like?
They see that it yeah. was a breakthrough film,
right.
and did they love it? And I would like
right.
to have seen that.
And of course,
that,
there's 50,000 people that attend Sundance now. The festival back in '89 was not quite that size,
mm-hmm.
and you can imagine the buzz traveled around town maybe a little bit quicker, and you got a sense for how a film was being
yeah.
you know, responded to.
To me, that was a sign of your genius, you know. See, because it's not enough for a man to climb Mount Everest. You know, he got to do that shit with the least amount of tools.
It's about the man, one man.
One man and his skill.
Like the samurai say, the sword is only as powerful as its master.
And it ain't the size of the dog in the fight.
Okay, well, our number three pick is the movie Hustle and Flow from 2005, won the Audience Award in the dramatic category and also won an award for cinematography, and it was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize. We heard in the last segment from writer-director Craig Brewer, and Hustle and Flow was really his breakout film, one of our favorite films of 2005, and after seeing the crowd reaction to Black Snake Moan,
oh, yeah.
I can only imagine how well Hustle and Flow would have gone over, because it is such a crowd-pleasing film. We talk about the music and how this film, Black Snake Moan, is such a musical film, just the filmmaking style of it. It feels like you're listening to a great blues record, and certainly the hip-hop music is so good yeah. in Hustle and Flow, and it's such an inspirational film
yeah.
that I think people would have really responded to it. I know we would have responded to it, and Terrence Howard as this Memphis pimp trying to live his dream of becoming a rapper, just an amazing performance.
Yeah, completely amazing. And I mean, I remember the screening I saw. I think I was in Milwaukee at the time, half-filled audience, when I saw Hustle and Flow, you know, in its general release. That was a thrilling, exciting experience. You know, there were people getting up and you know, cheering at the end of that film.
Mm-hmm.
I can only imagine. The Eccles Theater, 1,200 capacity, the actors, the director, they're there. It would have been completely
mm-hmm.
electric. All right, well, our number two, I was actually surprised to see that this film played Sundance, and it's Christopher Nolan's Memento, which played the festival in 2001 as part of the World Dramatic category, and it actually won. It's the World Dramatic category. Talk about just kind of a mind-blowing experience, I think, and really, you know, you walk out of the film. I remember walking out of the film completely disoriented
yeah.
when I saw it. I can just imagine as a part of that, you're already saturated with film, your mind is already buzzing, and you walk out of Memento for the first time, not knowing what to expect, and you sit down and watch that film. I mean, how much expectation did we walk into it, knowing so much about that film?
Right.
When we saw Memento, walking into a film like that,
totally.
Just being
just be surprised.
Yeah. And I that would just be incredible. I think
yeah.
just the buzz of walking out of a theater
mm-hmm.
after a screening, the first screening of Memento, everyone sort of audibly scratching their
yeah.
heads, you know, turning to their neighbors, what just happened,
right.
piecing it together.
But loving it. And I think that's
oh,
the
yeah.
key. I read today, actually, in one of the kind of Sundance newspapers, they had a Q&A with one of the programmers who's been at Sundance for a long time. And one of the questions was, what's the word or phrase you love to hear the most just kind of on the street? And his response was, that was weird, but I loved it.
Wow.
And I instantly, when I read that, thought of Memento, because
sure.
that would be a film that if you were at Sundance, you would walk out and be like, that was bizarre,
yeah.
but I loved it. Yeah. I think that would be kind of the general consensus, and it did.
Can you imagine the Q&A with Christopher
exactly.
Nolan after that screening?
Explain
yeah,
that
tell
to
us,
me.
Tell me what happened.
But it did win a screenwriting award and was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize, so Memento, a great film. It's our number two best Sundance breakout ever, and our number one, Sam, is Reservoir Dogs, a
yeah.
film we probably should throw into the penalty box if it's not there already
right.
and never talk about again, but Quentin Tarantino's film from 1992 won the Grand Jury Prize in
yeah.
the dramatic category. And again, we're picking out films here that we genuinely love, but also factoring in that experience, the Tarantino dialogue, the music, the pop culture references.
Oh.
We can imagine watching it with that audience, seeing how that movie-loving audience would have eaten all of that up. And it's a movie that I've said many times before on our show, had a huge influence on me, really
right.
prompted me to get into cinema. I wanted to learn more about the directors Tarantino was inspired by and stealing from. And so Reservoir Dogs has to be the number one.
It has to be the number one. And I remember seeing a clip of an interview that Tarantino was doing in front of an audience at Comic-Con, the comic convention earlier this year, or actually at the end of 2006, and somebody stood up and asked and said, you know, is it harder to get an independent film made now than when you released Reservoir Dogs in 92? And he said, not if you make Reservoir Dogs. And he's like, that was his advice. You know, it's just like, you want to get a film seen by people at Sundance and elsewhere, make Reservoir Dogs.
Right.
You know,
which
and it's just
easy.
Like, hey, yeah, that's easy to say. Easier said than done. But absolutely. And just electric. I mean, where you just, I can't imagine that anybody there seeing Reservoir Dogs felt like they had seen anything like that previously.
Yep.
So.
Okay, well, that is our wrap-up of the Sundance Film Festival from 2007. Again, we saw around 20 films and have managed to share with you five or six of the ones that really stood out for us, as well as the ones all time that stood out. And we would love to get any feedback from you. Please send your top five or any other thoughts about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back next month on Chicago Public Radio with another top five and more reviews of new and recently released movies. In the meantime, you can go to filmspotting.net to listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
Next week on the podcast, we'll review David Lynch's latest mindbender, Inland Empire. This radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks to Utah Carroll for today's music. For Film Spotting, I'm Sam Van Holgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by the new PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at PeerFlix.com.
Hi there.
Hi.
Sam, Nick, nice
to
meet you.
All right.
Best setup.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you definitely get
best setup.
Look at this.
Yeah, mixing us in. You're going to get a good interview on this one.